Imagine your commute to work takes you deep into a subterranean realm, buried beneath billions of tons of volcanic rock.
Might have been 2 miles in.
That's what Janice Sanders got to do more than 40 years ago in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado.
You know, so you go 2 miles in and a couple thousand feet up. You're in the belly of the mountain.
In the 1980s, at the Sunnyside Mine northeast of Silverton, miners followed a vein of rock rich with gold. Blasting it apart, funneling chunks of ore down chutes, and hauling them out of the mountain on rail cars. As a geologist, Janice roamed around the matrix of tunnels, often alone.
You know, it's not all lighted. You depend on your headlamp. So if you turned off your light, you're in absolute darkness. Dark, darker, and darkest.
These were some of the final years of hard rock mining in Colorado. But at the time, gold prices were high and the Sunnyside Mine was still going. Janice Sanders' job was to take samples of newly extracted rock. One time she was by herself, heading down a tunnel when she passed a crew of muckers. That's what they call the guys who move ore around inside a mine.
There were some muckers. They were loading one of the rail cars with a mucking machine. And sometimes they would have to blast a big rock and stuff. And they're always supposed to watch to make sure nobody had gone past them so that they didn't shoot at the wrong time.
What do you mean by shoot?
Blast, you know, cause a blast, like to break a rock and stuff. Well, I walked by to go sample beyond them. So they'd seen me, you know, and they shot. They didn't wait till I came out.
They detonated.
They detonated a blast, and then it blasted all this dust and bad air, which if I'd been like 20 feet further, it would have killed me.
The charge exploded about 30 feet from Janice. And luckily, the explosion came from a side tunnel.
I was just a bit around the corner, you know, but close enough to get a little blast of rock dust and my helmet blown off.
It blew your helmet off?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, I was uninjured, just like, holy crap, that was close. You know, and it's just a lack of attention. You know, me making the assumption that they'd seen me go by, and maybe they hadn't, and them shooting without having made sure no one was coming.
And did you say anything?
No.
Why?
Well, this is something I thought about a lot, because I had other accidents in the mine, too. I didn't want to draw attention to myself as a female. I just didn't want to draw attention to the fact that I'd made a mistake, too.
In Colorado's history of hard rock mining, underground work was almost entirely done by men. But by the 1970s and 1980s, companies started hiring a few women, and Janice Sanders was one of them. She loved geology. She loved being underground. But she had to endure a work culture that was sometimes sexist and occasionally even hateful. She never really felt like she belonged. From Magic City Studios and KSUT Public Radio, welcome to Territories, a multimedia podcast and audio time machine. In each episode, we explore the stories embedded in Colorado's most iconic landscapes. Today, one woman's history working underground in the dying days of hard rock mining.
No, a little lighter weight, thank goodness.
So you had lighter weight stuff.
Yeah, a little narrow rock pick, yeah.
The mines around Silverton are all closed now, but you can still catch a glimpse of this lost world in the basement of the San Juan County Mining Heritage Museum.
Seeing the diggers hanging there, the yellow pants, I like seeing that.
The basement is fashioned to look like an underground mining tunnel. narrow gauge rail lines, iron carts full of ore, and primitive tools made of iron and wood from the early years of silver and gold mining, which drew immigrants from all over the world to Silverton in the late 1800s.
And then this right here, this little engine.
You can also find relics from the more recent past, too.
This is really cool. This is an electric engine.
Janice Sanders pats her hand on a boxy yellow machine, steel wheels, 3 feet high, sitting on a stretch of railroad line.
This was about the size that we had underground. You know, like we weren't, the big engines were at the bottom of the mine. And in the upper stopes, you'd have smaller engines like this little electric engine and smaller cars like that.
The walls and ceilings are covered with dark plaster, giving the space a cave-like feel.
This is really an accurate reproduction of a mine. They've done a great job with the chutes, the stope, the loaded mine car filled with really good ore. That's great ore.
It's a rail car the size of a hot tub, filled with chunks of broken rock that sparkle in yellow light.
You could see the pink rhodonite, and you can see pyrite, zinc ore, sphalerite.
What's that shiny stuff?
The shiny stuff that we're seeing here that looks, it's cubic and it's bright silver, that is galena, which is a lead ore.
It's pretty.
Yeah, it's really pretty.
Sanders stops in front of a wooden box.
That's a coffin skip there.
This box looks like a small coffin, long and narrow, standing on end, attached to a steel cable that disappears into a hole in the ceiling.
See, this is a hoist here, a small hoist. The miners would put their gear in this little box. You know, it's a little smaller than a coffin, actually.
And it's then, like a dumbwaiter for tools.
Yeah, a dumbwaiter for tools, and then they'd hoist it up the level so that they wouldn't have to carry all that. But, like, sometimes as a geologist or even the miners, we would ride these things up.
Wow. You climb into this. This is not even the size of a coffin.
Yeah, you could ride it up, you know, and I did. And then one time we had samples and one of my team members went down to send the coffin skip up for me to load the samples on. And it's supported by like a 6x6 post. And I stepped on that post and I was, you know, just wanting to be efficient, wanting to be a man. But I'm standing there and I'm going, God, I forgot my gloves. I can't stand the feel of the gritty, wet dirt and rocks and like that. My gloves were laying about 5 feet away. And I was just fighting my mind, like, I want to be tough, but I hate that feeling. I stepped off that 6x6 and it cracked and the thing fell 200 feet down.
I mean, yeah. This was a dangerous job.
Yeah, it was a dangerous job. Yeah.
Janice Sanders hasn't worked in mining for over 30 years, but in this museum, the thrill of the work, the mix of danger and professional satisfaction, comes flooding back for her. She was still a teenager in junior college when she fell in love with earth science.
My first geology class, I finally figured out what I wanted to do. Prior to that, I hadn't any interest in any vocation. And then, I don't know, it just intrigued me. I like to think of it as the karma of geology. Where did it come from? What made all this variance of rocks and rock styles and how volatile it is, the ground turned upside down and flipped over, you know? And I just loved it. I was so excited by it. It just really generated my interest.
Following college and a few short-term jobs, she returned to the San Juan Mountains.
I'd already worked at the Sunnyside Mine while I was finishing college as a sampler, you know, going underground and taking samples. So I came back to Silverton and I got hired on as a full-time geologist. But I think I hit the jackpot. You know, being here, settling down, working underground, I kind of love the adventure, you know, just wandering around that mine. My job was to go and look where they'd blasted the night before and then go and sample, and I would just go everywhere in the mine by myself.
Is Does that mean when you're walking around, you're ducking into tunnels or what?
Oh, yeah, we're walking into, well, we didn't call them tunnels. We'd call them stopes or, yeah, but tunnels. Tunnels works. Yeah, we would walk into tunnels. The mine is like a honeycomb or like an anthill. There's tunnels. We'll call them tunnels going in all directions. You go up, you go sideways. Just following the vein, that's our job, to follow the vein and mine as close to the mining width of the vein as possible so you get all the ore without dilution, but don't miss any of the ore.
You know, this was a time in your life when these mines were active, when this industry was active here. It was at the tail end of all that. And the fact that we're in a museum and this is the best place to come to have this conversation says something about what's happened. I mean, we're talking about essentially a lost world.
Yeah, I've thought of that. I felt so fortunate to be able to live an end of an era. It's like, you know, you're a little kid and you're watching a Western movie and you know we don't live in the Wild West anymore, but you just have that nostalgic feeling. And I just feel so grateful that I had the opportunity to work and live that.
When you look back at this life that you lived, is this lost world lost for ill or mostly for good, or how do you see it?
It's kind of a mixed bag. I would say mining went downhill here and other places in the U.S. because of economics. You know, the cost of mining for the return wasn't making a profit. So it was impossible. You know, at that time, gold went to $800 and people went crazy. And then when it dropped again, it just wasn't economic to mine anymore. You know, sometimes I feel a little sad that we don't have the same community we had with the mining community. It was tight, really tight. We had big town dinners called the Knife and Fork Club and just a lot of things where community came together.
Do you think it was because you all lived and suffered and worked in the mines?
I think it was also because it was a small town, a lot of snow, and not much else to do. Yeah, but I also think it was a community that worked together in the mines. I can't say I was a tight part of it because it was more of a brotherhood, but I could witness it. Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting that you sort of correlate the economy of mining with a kind of community texture and vibe that existed because of it that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of, you know, like I'm going to equate it to a football team in a small school. We're all on the same team. We all have the same goals. We're working together, you know, to make this thing happen. So a lot of like-minded people, I guess. And then basically when you have like-minded people, it's a community.
In some ways, Janice Sanders misses that tight-knit community and the adventure of working underground. It was a job that allowed her to fulfill her dream of working as a geologist. And yet, as a woman, she still felt like an outsider.
I did want to be here. And so part of it's pride. You know, you want to be here because you did this education, you love this kind of work, you know, you put up with a lot, you know, because you really feel good that you've got this job and other people maybe would have liked it too. But being in the boys' club and not being a part of it, it was a little tough. Actually, I wouldn't want to be in a part of it, but I didn't like the discrimination. One team always called me, I thought they were calling me Peaches.
It was a Spanish word, right?
Yes, Peaches. So I found out it was boobs. But I thought it was Peaches. So I was okay with it, you know? And I didn't understand it, so I wasn't offended, thank God. And they were just decent people, kind of just making a joke. You know, like, the guys all had nicknames too. You know, some of them much worse than boobs. So, you know, so there were, you know, some little things like that, but you can deal with that.
It was difficult for Janice to decode the behavior of the men she worked with underground. Some guys were friendly and professional, but there was hazing, from light, friendly jokes to stuff that had more of an edge. Janice says there were probably men who disliked working with women, but didn't admit that openly. There were also men who made clumsy but earnest efforts to build rapport with her. But in a few of her interactions with male mine workers, an unmistakable meanness came to the surface, sometimes even naked hostility. Janice, for her part, responded with toughness, indifference, and silence.
In those days, it really felt like if you can't tough it out, you shouldn't be there. And I felt like I had to act like one of the guys, you know, in order to not get more harassment.
Looking back, she is sure that some of these men were testing her.
They probably thought if they harass her enough, she'll leave.
It was like a game of cat and mouse played on the checkerboard of 1980s gender politics. A game that no one acknowledged was afoot, including and especially not Janice.
They were pushing me to see if I cracked. You know, can you be as tough as we are? Can you hang here? Can you do this? That shouldn't have been part of my job, but it became part of my job.
It would start sometimes right at the beginning of the workday when mine workers gathered at the opening of the tunnel that led into the mine.
We all come to work. We're at the opening of the American Tunnel. We all get our diggers on. That's what we call those safety outfits, the overalls. We call them diggers. So we put on our yellow pants, our yellow jacket. We get geared up.
And once workers have their gear on, they board a train together.
You ride in on the man train going into work every day, and everybody kind of dozes off on that train ride in.
Remember, it is early, and they are sitting in seats that face one another. For the train ride in, almost all of the workers turn their headlamps off. But there is one employee who always sits facing Janice, and this guy leaves his headlamp on.
This guy would just shine his light right in my face. And nobody, if you work underground, you don't shine your light in people's face. This guy would intentionally, the only guy with his headlamp on, shine at my face.
The whole ride.
The whole ride. He was just an awful person. I mean, God rest your soul.
So he's not alive anymore?
Probably not.
Did you ever talk to him at all?
Oh, no.
So do you want to name him or no?
Yeah, I can name him. His nickname's Shorty.
Once at work, Shorty finds other ways to antagonize Janice. Shorty is a hoistman. He operates the skip, which is what miners call the elevator that moves people from one level to another. And it might be good to map things out a little here. Remember, the mine is like a honeycomb. There are vertical shafts going up and down that connect each level, and there are horizontal shafts that reach the various areas that miners are working on. Miners are working in different areas of what essentially is a three-dimensional labyrinth. Often they're working in almost complete darkness and separated by long distances. So anyone who wants to move from one level to another in the mine has to interact with the hoist operator. And the way workers communicate with this operator is by pulling a chain that is attached to a bell. Depending on the level you're on and the level you want to get to, you ring the bell a certain number of times, like a code.
I don't remember the codes now, I apologize. But let's just say I'm on F level and I'm ready to go down. Maybe I would pull the chain two times or something. The skip would rise and get you.
But on the days Shorty is working, calling for the skip is not straightforward for Janice.
If he knew or if he suspected it might be me, he might get the skip up there. I'd get on, he'd drop it a little and then just not move it. So he'd trap you on it.
He'd trap you on it?
Yeah, he would know like who would go up onto which different levels, you know. The crews would go up first, and then the geologists, surveyors would go up after all the crews would go. So if I was the only geologist that went to F level, and he knew that, and then I was signaling to return down, he would obviously know that I was the only one on F level. And then when I'd want to come down, he'd let me get on the skip, he'd drop it like 20 feet in the dark, and then just strand it.
And how long would he strand you for?
Until somebody else called or, you know, just, you know, 20 minutes maybe.
And what would you do?
Oh, I don't know. I would just wait and get off and get out of there.
And you never said anything? You never talked to him?
I did not. I never did.
Was this another instance of you just not wanting to acknowledge that he'd gotten you in some way?
Probably, you know, not letting him know he might have, not letting him have the feeling that he won. Yeah, because I don't think he ever did.
So you would just sit there in the dark for 20 minutes waiting for him to bring you down to the level?
Yeah, I have a good imagination. Yeah, it's like, oh, I got 20 minutes. Yeah.
But would you be angry?
I didn't like it, I will say that. Yeah, I guess I was angry. I really disliked him. He's like, you know, one of those guys who would pick on the littlest kid in the playground. You know, he wouldn't pick on the big guys. I guess he thought I was fair game.
Shorty may have been harassing Janice because she was a woman, or maybe not.
I thought he was obnoxious to everybody, to tell you the truth.
Scott Fetchenhier is Janice Sanders' ex-husband. Back in the 1980s, when they were still married, Scott worked at the Sunnyside Mine, too. And he's got a few vivid memories of Shorty.
If I remember, Shorty didn't have any teeth, you know, so, and I can't remember if he wore his dentures or not. He was pretty ornery, though, kind of a string bean guy, tall. You know, he was tall, but they called him Shorty. Everybody had a nickname at the mine, and he could be pretty obnoxious. And it wasn't probably just Janice, because I remember miners hassling Shorty, and he just popped the brake and dropped the skip into the water, into the sump, you know, and all of a sudden the water's rising in the elevator, the place where the miners are standing, and they're scrambling up ladders. He just dumped them in the water. But I didn't know he was hassling Janice, and he was definitely like old school miner, one of these guys that I could just picture being like that, you know, chauvinistic and what's a woman doing in the mine and different things like that. But there are a lot of guys with that attitude.
Scott does remember days when sexism at work got to Janice.
I think she was getting harassed all the time by one or two of these guys. And a couple nights, after getting harassed by some of the staff she worked with, she came home in tears, and this is a pretty tough woman. For those women to break into that at that time was really quite something, you know, and for them to stay with their jobs, even with the abuse and catcalls and this and that, I think was pretty brave.
He does recall one time when he and Janice arrived to work together. They were both heading into the mine to start their shift at the same time.
Janice and I got onto the skip to go to an upper level, and this older gentleman got on the skip, and she got off, let's say, at D level, and I went on up to an upper level or something like that. And when she got off, the older man looked at me and says, "Man, I'd sure like to get a little bit of that. Man, that looks pretty good to me." He didn't know it was my wife, so I didn't say anything to him. And the next day he came and he goes, "Oh my God," he says, "I didn't know that was your wife. I'm so sorry I talked about her like that. You can hit me if you want, you know?" And I said, "Relax, just don't do it again."
There are thousands of historic black and white photos online taken during the boom years of hard rock mining in Colorado. Of all the images of mine workers holding tools and posing in tunnels, Scott Fetchenhier has never seen a single woman in the old photographs.
It was the times, especially the early days, that was a man's job. I can't think of a single picture in all these years of going through photos of mines all over the world, except for probably Russia. Definitely there were women miners in Russia, but I've never seen them in America. I mean, I just don't see pictures of women working underground ever.
By the 1970s, equal employment laws and legal action pushed mining companies to start hiring women. According to the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, less than 1% of U.S. mine workers were female in the early 1970s. Within a decade, women accounted for almost 7% of the mining workforce. But even then, it was still very unusual for a woman to do the actual mining work underground.
I think some of the men just felt that a woman couldn't do their job, you know, because they're lifting 120-pound drills and running this heavy machinery. But it turns out a woman can do it just as well. I mean, I had trouble lifting those 120-pound drills.
And beyond the belief that women were not capable of doing the work, there were other things that made men uncomfortable.
There was this age-old superstition that women in a mine were bad luck. So they didn't even want to give women tours of mines, like if you were working at a mine or anything like that. My friend Charlie Ross, who I worked with at the Pride of the West Osceola, you know, I just remember him saying that. We don't want women in the mines, you know, they're bad luck. Well, Charlie invited his wife, she was on him, to take her into his working place. She says, I want to see what you do. He didn't want to do it because he was so superstitious. Edith finally convinced him, and he took Edith into the mine where he was working at, showed her the working area, how he was drilling and different things like that, and all was fine and dandy. Well, the next day, this big slab came off of the wall and fell right across his hand, broke his fingers, and really sliced him bad, and he blamed his wife for that.
I asked Janice Sanders whether she had encountered traces of superstition from the men she worked with underground.
I'd heard that, and I think there might be some that really still held to that. But most of the people that I met were just really decent people that didn't follow that.
You never heard anybody articulate that superstition.
I did hear it, but I would point out you've had more accidents before I was here than while I'm here. So,
you heard it from who?
I'm not sure. You know, just in
like banter?
A little bit, yeah. Bad luck. Bad luck's here.
When she was studying geology in the 1980s, women were joining the mining workforce in small but significant numbers.
Well, there were a lot of women in my class. I mean, there was definitely more men, but it was new. I mean, we're boomers, so, you know, women in the working force was sort of still new, even in the 1980s. Especially, you know, and I guess you would call it a professional job that had traditionally been a man's job.
Janice never met any women who did the actual mining work, extracting ore.
You know, I don't know the woman that worked on one of the mining teams, but I've known of them. I've heard stories from even some of the guys that I worked with who talk about, hey, there was this gal, and man, she could carry two jack legs, and, you know, yeah, it's cool. There were women in mining. You know, a lot of women, this is way before my time, but they would work outside hand sorting the ore, women and children. So they've had a part in mining, too.
Inside the mine, there was a lighted, heated room they called the doghouse. It was a break room where underground workers could rest and relax during their shift.
We'd leave our pie cans or our lunch boxes with our lunch there. We'd have electric heaters on the ceiling, and we could bring something that we would want to heat up, and we could put it under the electric heaters. And then when we came back for lunch, we'd have hot lunch. And it was a nice break room and basically okay.
One day, Janice arrived to take her lunch break, and she found that one of the other geologists, a guy she worked closely with, had made some changes to the interior of the doghouse.
This is one of my team workers. He put up pinup posters all over, just coated the walls with it.
Nude photos of women.
Yes, nude photos of women.
I'm assuming they're ripped out of magazines.
Yeah, all over the doghouse. And
who was this person?
I don't want to say his name, but he'll know. and I, you know, of course, I wasn't really fond of it. I didn't like it, but I didn't do anything about it.
For a week, workers ate their lunches in the doghouse, surrounded by images of nude women. During that time, just one coworker asked Janice how she felt. She says she pretended that she hadn't noticed.
Then one day I came in and they were all ripped down. And, you know, it was his pride and joy. So he was just upset as all get out. But it wasn't me who took him down. It was one of the engineers who found it very offensive and just didn't think it was cool.
How did you find out it was one of the engineers?
He told me.
What did he say?
He said, "That guy's disgusting." Yeah, I know. I've been working with him. Since my first day underground, I've been working with him. I just want to reiterate that there were more good people down there than those few bad eggs. But I just felt like it was a trial by fire every single day. It's like a kid being bullied at school, you know, you just want to get through the day. You want to avoid recess or any situation where you might be isolated with somebody who's going to harass you. There were three mine shift bosses then, and two of them were awesome. And one of them was like, oh, you'd walk in and you just feel it, you know. Disdain, you could just feel it dripping off of him. He just hated, well, I don't think he hated me personally. He hated me being female in the mine. He didn't know me, so he had no reason to hate me, but he hated having a female in the mine. He was a piece of work.
It was a precarious environment that women mine workers faced in the 1980s. On paper, they were fully vested employees with equal protection under federal law. In reality, women were embedded in a work culture where camaraderie and humor blurred with sexism and misogyny. Working underground in a dangerous profession, women needed to rely on male coworkers, and some of those men did not view them as equals. For Janice Sanders, survival on the job meant staying silent. And occasionally, that led to some very dangerous encounters.
Yeah, there were some times I didn't feel safe. You know, high grading went on in this mine.
High grading?
That would be where, you know, the miners would blast and, you know, they'd see the fresh rock and they would see the glint of gold. You know, you could see free gold. And in this one place, these guys found, you know, a good stash of visible gold. And they hid it, you know, somewhere.
Hid it, meaning they concealed it.
They concealed it so they could come back and get it later. Well, before they could come back and get it, someone else had found their stash.
Somebody had found their stash and taken it.
Taken it. So the only other person who had been on that level is me, the geologist, who has to go up there and sample that level. So I got my sample, I'm leaving, and then these guys show up. And they just came at me like I'd taken it and threatened me. And I'm going, I didn't take your gold.
And then what happened?
Well, they just cornered me. I was out of the stope and, you know, ready to get back on the lift. And they cornered me asking where their gold was. The guy was kind of aggressive anyway. And he said, you stole our gold. You know, I kept backing up and, you know, they were just getting in my face and they can push you down a hole and make it look like an accident. You know, I got out of there with my life and without their gold, I didn't take it. I guess they figured out that it wasn't me somehow because they didn't do it the next day. But yeah, it was scary.
And who did you talk to about it?
I didn't.
No one?
No.
In this particular profession, in this particular work environment, it's not just that you don't get to feel like you belong. It's that you are in dangerous circumstances where you're an outsider. You couldn't defend yourself. You couldn't tell people about what was going on with you.
Yeah, well, I didn't tell people.
I guess you could have.
I could have. I really have no logical reason as the adult I am now of why I wouldn't tell then. Isn't that funny? Why? What would I do today? You know, I was just trying to preserve myself, self-preservation, be safe underground.
were other women who worked with Janice Sanders at the Sunnyside Mine, but she says she did not talk with female co-workers about sexism and discrimination on the job. She's friends with some of those same women now in Silverton, but to this day, she's never talked with those former co-workers about any of this.
No, I've never really talked to anybody in the profession as a geologist or the miners that I work with. I've talked to friends, you know, that aren't in mining about it.
Do you think these other women who worked, who were your contemporaries, would acknowledge that this went on?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure that some of them would. One time I'm coming down and I see a nasty sign about one of them, you know, and I'm going, so I'm sure they noticed it.
What did you see?
Oh, it was just nasty graphic drawing.
Of who?
One of the women who worked there in a professional capacity. I won't say their name or anything because it was pretty nasty. I didn't like it, but I didn't do anything about it. I just thought, I wonder why they're picking on her.
So I guess I have to ask, you didn't say anything then. You've never talked with your fellow female miners. Why now? Why are you talking now about this?
Because I, it's been a long time and I have daughters and I have grandchildren and I'm old enough now to know that I can stand up to it. I guess I'm just speaking about like the harassment now because I feel like I can, whereas I didn't feel like I could then. I've had employees of my own and they've come to me when somebody has harassed them and I've dealt with it for them. I couldn't do it for myself. But I can be strong for other people. That's what I've realized. Because when it's happened in the businesses that I've owned, I've dealt with it and there have been consequences. It makes me stronger to do it for someone else. But in doing that, I know that I have grown in myself that I would protect myself now. And I would definitely call a spade a spade.
You know, we were talking at the beginning of this conversation about this lost world of hard rock mining in Silverton and the fact that you got to be a part of that world at the tail end of the mining economy here and the privilege that you had. And downstream in the conversation, you know, we've talked about all the things that you endured in order to be a part of that world. Do you have any memories that you cherish of the really good side of being underground and working as a geologist?
Yeah, there was this experience like the miners in 1978 had mined very close to the surface. And there was a lake called Lake Emma that was up there. And they got close enough that that lake flooded the entire mine and it shut it down. No one was in the mine when it happened or they all would have been killed. But it flooded the mine. A whole lake just went through it like a bathtub in an anthill. Then when I came to work there, this was after they'd been cleaning up after the flood and stuff, and I got to go up on one of the old, old levels that they'd worked, I don't know, 50 years before, and nobody'd worked up there. I could find old dynamite boxes and stuff like that. So it was like really going back in time. Here's the thing that made me feel good, because I still felt like the new person and I'm working in a man's world, but I went up with a partner and we were gonna sample and we'd brought a jackleg, that's an air drill, and they're very powerful. Those things can be dangerous. The leg of the hydraulic drill pushes, so you're not just pushing on the rock, but the hydraulic system is pushing onto the rock. The guy that was running it, he was one of my coworkers, you know, it got away from him. And what can happen is that leg can expand up like that and pin you against the back. You could be trapped.
Up against the ceiling of the...
You could be trapped against the ceiling or rib and the drill would just hold you there and nothing you can do. And I was still kind of new and I kind of froze looking at him trying to control that drill. And I reached down and turned the air off. And I just thought, how did I know how to do that? And that made me feel good, being up there underground and just having some insight come to me. Yeah, that was kind of cool.
And what did he say to you when you turned off the jackleg?
That was good thinking.
So he was appreciative.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting that you cherish that memory.
Yeah, because I didn't know how I knew how to do it.
faced with a difficult, potentially life-threatening situation underground, you did the right thing and you had good instincts.
Yeah. I do. I appreciate that experience because it made me feel like I'm in the right place at the right time. I'm okay to be here in this job.
I mean, maybe even, dare we say, you belong in this job.
Yeah, I did like it, yeah.
Janice Sanders has started more than a dozen businesses in the San Juan Mountains that cater to tourists. While she doesn't get the same thrill in retail, she says there are upsides to working above ground.
Retail's not too dangerous. Might get a paper cut. It's not the adventure that mining was. It really was like stepping into a different reality and then coming out every day and going back in the next day. Yeah, I'm really happy I had that opportunity. That's, I guess, what I really want to say. I lived the end of an era. Yeah, and this won't be happening again. Not like it was.
Janice Sanders worked in the mining industry for a little more than a decade. She still lives in Silverton, Colorado. You're listening to Territories, an audio time machine and multimedia history podcast produced by Magic City Studios in partnership with KSUT Public Radio. Support for Territories comes from the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority and from the Southwest Colorado Local Organizing Committee, working to commemorate Colorado's 150th anniversary of statehood. Additional support for this story comes from the Red Line Arts and Society Program in Denver, Colorado. Special thanks this week to Beverly Rich, Scott Fetchenhire, Steve Rich, Janice Sanders, and the Mining Heritage Museum in Silverton, Colorado. Thanks also go out to Tammy Graham, Ken Brott, and Mark Dugan at KSUT, and to Ellen Roberts and Ellen Babers in Durango for their support of this project. You can find out more about Territories, get involved with the project, and share your story ideas with us by visiting our website, theterritories.net. I'm Adam Burke. The landscape has many more stories to tell. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we'll see you next time for another episode of Territories.